Do you love the American Constitution? We too. Please help letting this podcast survive in the current cancel culture. Amazon recently deleted our Peter Canceler collection, probably for being too cheap. It was Locke, Hobbes, and the US Constitution for only $15. Check out our Peter Canceler at Barnes & Noble, Lulu, or do a quick DuckDuckGo search to buy American collections that come at the lowest price possible to keep civil law great. That's PeterKanzler, featuring the original texts from Locke, Hobbes, Rousseau, the US Constitution, Machiavelli, and many more, always bound together in just one book. Thank you very much.
Good luck.
Thank you. Absolutely. All right. Hello. So I'm going to talk about this carnivorous human and then carnivorous humans more generally. Nora Gedgetaus at AHS 16 last year said, "How much, if anything, metabolically dysregulating or inflammatory or disruptive of your endocrine and immune system, or even potentially autoimmune provoking, do you want to enjoy in moderation?" That's, I think, a great answer to eating in moderation, although I think moderation usually has an implicit assumption that the things that you're selecting are not going to be damaging in small amounts. So you don't eat cyanide in moderation. So I eat a balanced diet too. I eat all the food groups, lots of fat and flesh from mainly ruminants, that is beef and lamb and goat, pork, fish and shellfish, poultry, eggs, and probably other things that I haven't thought of. I'm going to use the word meat a lot and sometimes the phrase animal-sourced food. If in your dialect some of these words don't mean meat, please substitute that in your mind. Here are some things I've been accused of my reasoning for doing this, and none of them are the truth. It's not that I'm a zealot or a Puritan and need to follow rules. It's not that I'm an ascetic. In fact, I'm kind of a hedonist. And it's not that I'm afraid of plant foods. The reason that I eat this way, I came for the fat loss and I stayed for the mood stability. So here's a brief history of my dietary journey so far. I was brought up vegetarian, and I was always fighting pudge, at least in between growth spurts. When I went to university, I didn't gain your freshman 5, it was more like 30. And I finally discovered low-carb diets in 1997 when I was 24 with this book right here. This book sent me to the kitchen, and it also sent me to the library because it was full of references which were fascinating because they were all very different from what I thought that I knew. And it completely fixed my weight problem at the time. But over the years, I began to slowly regain the weight. And I don't know if that was because of aging or because of pregnancies or some other thing. But I found myself in 2009 very, very frustrated and at the end of my rope. And I had heard of some people who were doing a meat-only diet. And I thought it's not terribly different from the induction phase of Natkin's diet. And so I decided to try that, and I was sure that as soon as I got my weight stabilized, I would return to my regular low-carb diet. But that's not what happened. I somehow found myself in this position of being healthier without vegetables. It's not only that I lost the 60 pounds of fat that I had been carrying and with no effort, but a debilitating mood disorder that I had had for many, many years and which I thought was not really addressable with a diet. I had been diagnosed with major depressive disorder when I was about 20, and then about a dozen years later, I was re-diagnosed with a form of bipolar disorder, bipolar type 2, which is like manic depression but without true mania. And although I did notice a correlation between my mood and the amount of carbohydrate I was eating, even a very low-carb diet was not stopping it from progressing. And here I was feeling like I was completely cured. So how could this possibly be true, that I'm doing something that I know is not really the best for your health, and I'm healthier? So I'm going to take a very shallow dive into the following topics. I'm going to talk about herbivores because that's our evolutionary heritage, the keyword being from, what we evolved from, and the role of meat versus plants in animal diets, including our diets. I'm going to talk about micronutrients and fiber and antioxidants and toxins and snowflakes. Okay, so the strategy for herbivores is that they eat copious amounts of low-quality forage, and they eat continuously, and they process repeatedly, which I'll get back to. When I say low-quality, I'm not making a value judgment. Some nutritional ecologists have used this to try to quantify diets in herbivores. These were some scientists studying primates who came up with this formula, where basically you have the percent of plant structural parts plus 2 times their reproductive parts plus 3.5 times the animal prey in their diet as a way to determine quality. And the other thing that is not widely recognized, you think of herbivores as eating plants, so they must be getting most of their energy from carbohydrates, right? But actually, mammals, most of the food that herbivores eat is actually fiber, and mammals can't digest fiber. But microbes can. Microbes can ferment fiber into microbes, or into short-chain fatty acids, so acetate, propionate, and butyrate. And that's where they get almost all of their energy. And then those short-chain fatty acids are further converted into ketones and some glucose and saturated monounsaturated fat. There are basically 2 ways that they do this. If you think about your digestive system, there are basically 4 parts. There's the stomach, which breaks things down, and the small intestines, which does the absorption, and then the large intestines, which consists of the cecum and the colon, where there's further absorption. If you're going to ferment, you can either do that in the foregut, which means you're doing it at the stomach level. And that's what ruminants and pseudoruminants do. They have multiple stomachs. And here's where the repeated processing comes in. They will chew it to expose as much of the cell wall as they can for the fermentation and put it through some fermentation and then bring it back and chew it again and do that multiple times. And then it gets to go through the stomach. This is very efficient. In hindgut fermenters, so rabbits, rodents, horses, gorillas, and chimpanzees, they have the fermenting vat on the other side of the small intestines. They have a cecum, which we only have an appendix left, but they had a huge vat of microbes in the cecum to do this fermentation. But then that's the end of it. They can't process it again, so what they typically do is eat it again. That's coprophagy, and that's our pre-human evolutionary heritage. And if you really want to do herbivory right, you should be eating your food twice. So why are we different? Well, a little over 20 years ago, some anthropologists noticed this puzzling observation. Brains are extraordinarily expensive, and we have really big brains, even for primates. And primates already have pretty large brains for mammals. But our metabolic rates aren't much different than you would expect, just given that we're primates and given our size. So where are we getting all this extra energy to fuel our brains, and how could this have evolved? Well, they noticed something else that happened at the same time. We basically gave up our intestines. Here's a picture of the evolution of the size of the human brain. It basically tripled in size from that inflection point almost 2 million years ago. That's where we first started getting the genus Homo. Here is a comparison of the relative size of those 4 parts of the digestive system. So compared to some other primates, if you look especially at the last 3 bars, we're the very last one, and gorilla and chimpanzee next to them. We have approximately the same percentage of stomach, but then most of what we have is the small intestines, and we have no cecum to speak of, really, and drastically reduced colon size. And the thing to notice about this is that if you put this all together, we have these enormous brains that were evolving over that time, and they need a lot of energy. And we've traded this tissue, this intestinal tissue, which was comparably energy intensive, for brain tissue. And in the course of doing that, we lost the ability to ferment appreciable amounts of fiber into fat. So we gave up that ability. And therefore, in order to consistently get that fuel, we made ourselves reliant on a high-quality diet. So how much fiber can we actually ferment? Well, this is just a quick kind of back-of-the-envelope calculation, but you can get maybe about 2 calories of short-chain fatty acids out of 1 gram of fiber. And even the ADA, which is very much in favor of putting fiber in your diet, cautions against eating more than about 20 or 35 grams, and the reasons they cite is because we can't process it, and they acknowledge that you will have gastrointestinal distress, cramping, diarrhea, constipation, gas, sometimes worse, as in permanent kinds of damage. And if you add that up, that comes out to about 70 calories, which if you're that standard male that they always talk about who eats 2,000, that's about a little under 5%. There is an often cited figure of 6 to 10%, and you may or may not believe it. It doesn't have a big impact on the argument, but I don't quite believe it, because what they did to come up with that number was that they took some real measurements in Britain of people eating 15 grams of fiber and calculated how much short-chain fatty acid they were getting, and then just extrapolated that to what would happen if you could absorb all of what they had seen reports of other people eating in other countries. What do you get when you eat a high-quality diet? Well, we needed protein, and we also needed energy, and we couldn't get that energy from fiber anymore. And the plants that were available during that time were very, very fibrous. They weren't the kind of plants that you see that have been gone through all this special breeding to get more starch in them. They were very fibrous, and they couldn't meet caloric needs. They were very low in protein, and they were also seasonal. And then remember, this is also an ice age. So suppose you might get some bursts of plant material, but you need to eat all year round, and you need to eat year after year for 2 million years. So you need something consistent. Whereas the animals that were available at the time were way fatter and bigger than the modern lean game that you might look at and say, what could we eat if we hunted now? It also entails a lot of nutrients. So remember, our brains are the important thing for development here, and we needed consistently to have certain kinds of nutrients that are very difficult to get out of plant diets. They're either not very available or they're not bioavailable. So just a few examples, we've got iron and zinc and DHA and vitamin A and D and iodine. If you don't get enough of these, your brain simply doesn't develop properly, and you will have sometimes lasting damage. So animal-sourced food is not an optional component of the human diet, especially not when we didn't have access to special supplements to try to make up for deficits. It's not just those particular nutrients. I focused on them because of their importance in the brain. In truth, there really isn't any vitamin or mineral that we need that animal-sourced foods can't provide. I'm just briefly going to mention vitamin C because that's the most contentious one. I have a couple of blog posts about this with a lot of references if you want to refer to it. But it's been long known, over 100 years, that fresh meat by itself cures scurvy. So that should be enough to give you pause right there. But when I looked into it, I found out that the RDAs are grossly inflated. There is a paper that the USDA themselves cite which shows that 10 milligrams a day is sufficient. And I think they currently recommend at least 6 times that amount. And the reason that they say that is mostly based on speculation about the antioxidant properties of vitamin C, which I don't think are actually very important, especially on a low-carb diet. Low-carb diets reduce the need for vitamin C because of competition for uptake in the cells, among other reasons. And then another thing that I found that was really egregious, I thought, is that if you look up in your favorite table how much vitamin C is in meat, it'll say 0. But if you go back to the papers where they show the measurements of that, they didn't even measure it. They just assumed it was 0, whereas they measured almost everything else that they reported. Looking at some older papers on livestock, I found that about a pound of beef, maybe a little more, is probably up to about 10 milligrams. I don't know about the effect of cooking. I know that if you cook it all the way, that will cause quite a bit of loss, but there's definitely a lot more there than you might think. I think I've given at least some hints as to why plants are not sufficient, and argued that you have to have some meat in your diet to grow the brains that we've grown into to be people. And in addition, I'll just throw in, and this is just what we've found, that if you look back at all the societies that we have studied, not one of them was found that had no animal source food in their diet. So I've shown, I think, that plants are not necessary to get micronutrients, and they're not necessary to get energy, but one might be left wondering, well, is there something else that makes them important? Certainly, there must be some reason that the guidelines are telling us to eat them. What else could it be? How about fiber? Has anyone ever told you that fiber is important? Somebody once made this quote when arguing about something else, and it really stuck with me. One way that you can tell that a belief might be based on faith is that every time that the prevailing argument that it must be true is shown to be false, they quickly fall onto another one. So here are some previous arguments for fiber that have been made that have been shown to not really hold water. One is that they're important for preventing inflammatory bowel disease or keeping your colon healthy in that way. But in fact, fiber doesn't help with that, and it's often a hindrance. They've been used to argue that it helps with blood sugar, but I think that could only be argued if you're replacing some of your carbohydrate with fiber. The baseline is just very poor. How about this new argument about feeding the microbiome? I don't have time I could do a whole talk on this. I do think there is a lot of exciting research about the fact that we are recognizing that the microbiome is an active organ, and it's or an active organ-like component of our bodies, and that there are fascinating correlations being found between different diseases that we're finding on high-carb diets and bacterial strains that are found in the gut. But I really advise caution in interpreting these, because for one thing, any strain that is unlikely to have stayed without constant feeding seems to be unlikely to be important for our overall health. Does anyone think that we might have had some fasting periods after that? Could we have recovered without constant feeding? It just seems a little bit suspect. There have been studies about antibiotics being harmful, but some of them are spurious correlations. For example, I've seen criticisms where they showed an effect of obesity later in children who took antibiotics, but once you corrected for the kinds of diseases that they were having that caused them to have antibiotics, the effect of the antibiotics went away, so that's questionable. And in fact, some studies have shown that antibiotics are beneficial in autism, schizophrenia, and Alzheimer's, for example. I've seen papers showing good effect of antibiotics. I've also looked at germ-free mice who are brought up in isolation from bacteria, and it turns out they live longer and have healthier metabolisms. So I don't know what's up with that. Probiotics possibly could be giving their benefit by feeding strains that displace bad strains, and if you're not feeding any of them, then you don't need that. Similarly, if you just need the probiotics or prebiotics to take care of the fiber that you're eating, if you don't eat the fiber, then you don't need them. There's also some indication that ketogenic metabolisms may supplant the need for those short-chain fatty acids that we were getting, although that's a bit speculative. What about evidence from modern hunter-gatherers? I like to think of modern hunter-gatherers not as representing our Paleolithic evolution, but rather what happened when we were faced with this post-energy apocalypse, by which I mean the loss of the megafauna that we used to live on. If you know who Weston Price is, he went around a century ago studying many different societies, and he found that there were many different nutritional strategies that worked to get around this apocalypse. And of course, they all included some meat, but here are some strategies. Some of them learned really well how to extract more fat from the existing animals. I think that was critical. Some of them found substitute fats in nuts. Some of them, now by this time we had fire, hundreds of thousands of years possibly. I know that absence of evidence isn't evidence of absence, but there isn't yet evidence that fire went far back enough to have made tubers a reliable source for the whole course of the evolution period that I'm talking about. But we can certainly do that now. And then there are even societies that make good use of grains if they ferment them or do other things to get rid of the toxins. But what he also found that there were societies that didn't eat significant plants in their diets. So if plants were really necessary on a frequent, heavy basis, then we wouldn't have been able to find this variety of recent societies that ate plants rarely, that they survived so well. Not only did they survive well, Weston Price said this of them. In his primitive state, this of the Inuit in particular, he is provided an example of physical excellence and dental perfection such as seldom been excelled in any race in the past or present. We're deeply concerned to know the formula of his nutrition. And it wasn't just them. There are Plains Indians, Maasai, or a kind of special carnivorous case, drinking blood and milk. Mongolians, Gochos, basically anyone who lives a nomadic lifestyle tends to live mostly plant-free. So maybe you're convinced that plants aren't necessary, but could they actually be causing harm? And this is something that I really wanted to know, because how could just the difference between eating a low-carb diet with very high plant material and taking away the plants actually improve my health? And I'm not the only one who's found this. Here's something I got from Nina Teicholz on Twitter. This was to argue, look, we really have followed the guidelines. We're not obese because we haven't been following your advice. Look, our red meat went down significantly, our eggs went down significantly, but look what else changed significantly. We're eating way more fruit, way more vegetables, and way more nuts. It turns out, well, in this community, I think we know that saturated fat and cholesterol have been thoroughly exonerated as parts of the diet, and a lot of people are really quite outraged that the USDA would promote this without the kind of proper evidence you would expect for it. But what about the recommendations for vegetables and fruits? Surely there's evidence for that. Well, actually, there isn't. There's a similar lack of evidence. All the studies that are supposed to show these benefits are based on the same kind of ill-conceived studies based on observational data, epidemiology, or highly confounded interventions. And it's never actually been tested, or if it has been, it's been unpublishable. I did find one study, actually a couple of different papers from the same group on the same study on vegetable depletion, but it was kind of an accident, and I'm really pleased that they published it anyway. They were looking at smokers, and what they wanted to do was find out if green tea, the antioxidants in green tea, would help the smokers. And so they tried to find benefits, so as a way to get rid of confounding, they asked all the people to get rid of all the highly colorful flavonoid-containing fruits and vegetables out of their diets. I think they left them with potatoes and carrots. And they didn't find an effect that was useful with the green tea, but they did notice in the course of their study that removing flavonoids from the plants improved markers of oxidation, improved them. Here's what they said. The decrease in protein oxidation and 8-OxoDG excretion and the increased resistance of plasma lipoproteins to oxidation in the present study points to a more general relief of oxidative stress after depletion of flavonoid and ascorbate-rich fruits and vegetables from the diet, contrary to common beliefs. And that's the strongest study I could find, and it's not very supportive of the idea that fruits and vegetables are needed for that. Well, why would plants be unhealthy? Aren't they just growing for our benefit? Well, no. They want to survive too, and they can't run away, so most of their defenses are chemical ones. Here's just a list of the most common kinds of toxins that they use to kill herbivores, especially insects. Basically, you're eating a pile of insecticide when you eat a plant. There are alkaloids that are in nightshades. They can cause nerve transmission and DNA problems and alter carb and fat metabolism. There are cyanogenic glycosides, which happen in tapioca, which is a significant source of calories in some parts of Africa. They become toxic when you bite them, releasing things like cyanide. There are terpenoids, which are volatile oils. They're found in citrus and other plants. And our special darlings, the phenolics, which are flavonoids, tannins, lignin, cannabinoids. They basically just make it hard for you to digest protein, and may cause other problems as well. Now, I'm not anti-drug. I think drugs have a role, and I think that getting drugs out of plants can be very important to solve problems that are not quickly solvable by lifestyle intervention. And you can do that with plants. But it typically isn't a dose that you would just get from eating a salad. You would have to isolate it and concentrate it. And then you're going to have side effects like you would with any other drug. So I don't buy the argument that we should just be eating a whole variety of plants to make sure we're getting all these compounds that might somehow add up to helping us. They might somehow add up to harming us as well. Finally, about special snowflakes. I would say we're not special snowflakes, we're special snowflakes. We're all one species. We all have the same digestive system based on hydrochloric acid. We all have small guts, no cecum to speak of. None of us has a special ability to ferment fiber that others of us don't. And we all have enormous brains. So I do think that we vary in our tolerance to things, but I don't think that we vary in what we need. And so it may be the case that you can eat plants or you can eat a diet that would be stressful to my system and have it not be stressful to yours. But I don't think that there are humans who just need a lot of plants the way any more than there are lions that just need a lot of plants. There were a couple things that I wanted to address that I didn't about my own diet. For example, people always want to know, well, are you in ketosis? Yes, I am. It's usually mild to moderate, even though I eat a lot more protein than you probably do if you eat some carbohydrate. And we can talk about that after if you like. And please visit my website if you want to learn more.
Do you love the American Constitution? We too. Please help letting this podcast survive in the current cancel culture. Amazon recently deleted our Peter Canceler collection, probably for being too cheap. It was Locke, Hobbes, and the US Constitution for only $15. Check out our Peter Canceler at Barnes & Noble, Lulu, or do a quick DuckDuckGo search to buy American collections that come at the lowest price possible to keep civil law great. That's PeterKanzler. Featuring the original texts from Locke, Hobbes, Rousseau, the US Constitution, Machiavelli, and many more, always bound together in just one book. Thank you very much.